Ja.
And why are there Bernie bros and not Bernie hoes?
So there are.
Did we talk about having edibles at my holiday party?
And that I always underestimated is that men really like breasts.
Do you think I'm a Karen?
Valentine's Day is like New Year's Eve with nuclear weapons.
What you just said was so slut-shaming. And I wanted to
see how it's slut-shaming. Welcome to the Femsplainers. I'm Danielle Crittenden, and this is what I warned would be our very last Femsplainer podcast. And as promised, my original co-splainer, Christina Hoff Summers, is in my little home studio. And we're here with our, you've converted me to Dubonnet. You converted me to Dubonnet, where we've got each a glass of Dubonnet and with an orange slice, which I learned that's how one does it. We're going to be sophisticated with this otherwise 1970s.
It's still
drink.
Considered sophisticated in France.
In Spain, but nowhere else.
Not France? Maybe not.
Maybe France. But we just wanted to, first of all, thank all of you who have listened, especially those of you who've been here from the beginning. Our first podcast, Christina, if you remember, was How We Met and What We Drank.
Yes.
it's been such a fun time. Almost 4 years, over 150 podcasts.
And I remember when we started, my stepson Tamler, who has a podcast ongoing, he said, well, most people quit after 10 episodes. And I honestly thought we would. I thought, oh, 10 episodes, that's a lot. Will we make it? And look where it is now.
I do have this thing of bullying my friends into doing things. It's not a really admirable trait, but just as I had bullied Ann Applebaum into doing this Polish cookbook with me, I bullied you into doing this podcast. And I said, well, just do it. And if it's not fun, we'll stop.
But we had fun the beginning.
We did.
I was looking back at some of them. I mean, for me, there were a couple we did out of town, one in Nashville mm-hmm. with Joel Stein. And I love that. I love the trip. I loved him. And it's an example of the sort of thing that can happen when you do this. You met the people that we've met, and we were able to spend time with Caitlin Flanagan and our friends, Emily and Anne, and Emily Yaffe and Anne Applebaum, Megan Gurdon.
Right. They are regular. And a big shout out to, they were kind of regular co-splainers, Irshad Manji as well. Sandra Singh Lowe.
See, Irshad, it was just, she came into the studio and I was just so taken with her and I have followed everything she does ever since.
Right. And she's super impressive. Well, so let's think, what were some of our, I got a couple of things to ask. So what were some of your sort of, I don't want to, what my young children used to call favoritizing. I don't want to favoritize any particular guest, but I want to think, like, what were some of the more fun or unexpected podcasts that we did together?
Well, I guess the high point in terms of the number of downloads and just the whole experience was when Jordan Peterson came on.
Oh, that was, yes, that was, we had him on, it must have been at least 2 years ago. I'm sorry, we're going to be vague with these dates, but they're all up there on Podcast One and iTunes. Of course, you can scroll back down through them. But we had him on right at the sort of height of his fame, before he had that kind of overdose / nervous breakdown. And he was at that point just this guru to young men. Mm-hmm. And so we had him on to talk about actually himself, his marriage, and sort of his more personal life, like as in, who is this guy giving all this advice?
And he laughed a lot. I had, you know, just watching him, it was just a different side of him. It was fun.
Right. And we can talk about some of the changes that we've seen over the past, I'm just going to say 4 years, also changes in people we've known, how the politics has affected things and strange. We had a strange journey through the Trump administration.
Me too.
Well, that was what began it. The pandemic. We've all spent the pandemic. Together. Well, another one of the guests I had liked was going right back. We had on Leah McSweeney. I don't know if you remember Leia. She is now a huge reality television star. She's with the housewives of, you know, the Real Housewives of New York. People actually, including my daughters and their friends, go, oh my God, you had Leia McSweeney on. We had her on when she was fairly not well known, but she'd written this absolutely brilliant article for Tablet about the Women's March. Do you remember that?
She was, that's an example of someone that it was just a delight to meet. And what she'd exposed about the complete dissolution of that movement. Here right. They had all these women in good faith marching together, and then the politics of the leadership was absolutely corrupt.
Right. She was an entrepreneur, and I think remains so, with a clothing line in New York. And but she also just got fascinated in the politics behind what had been such an inspirational march that devolved into Marxism and what was the founders followed?
Louis
Farrakhan. And they sort of hijacked it from one of the original sort of good intention, as these movements tend to go.
In retrospect, you know? I don't think having pussy hats was the best symbol. That was kind of ridiculous. I don't think any movement could be taken seriously.
Well, it was sort of an in your face to grab them by the pussy moment.
I know. I understand.
But I think there was some comedian who said, you know, let's put on pink hats shaped like pussy.
Yeah. And it was Dave Chappelle that was joking about these movements. Like, I don't think Martin Luther King said, oh, let's wear matching outfits, you know,
pink hats to the mall. Like the reflecting pool. Let me think. Another one was Candace Bushnell.
Yes.
Talking about she wrote the original column, which was the basis for the original Sex in the City. And then she came out with a book on dating in her 50s. We had her in studio at that time. We were recording out of the American Enterprise Institute. And she was very hilarious about dating in one's 50s. And it kind of set the scene for now the new version and what was it called? Jeez. And
oh, I don't know, because apparently it's unwatchable.
And then just like that, set the scene for just like that, which I have not watched. Have you watched this?
No, I will not watch it. It just sounds so awful. I never liked the original show. I mean, I didn't dislike it. I just wasn't interested.
Right.
I didn't find it that funny. So I'm not curious to see them now, but apparently it's terrible.
Right. But so she was very funny about dating and the sort of also the horror of dating in one's 50s, even in her kind of fancy pants Hamptons world. It did not sound.
I can't imagine going on a date. Can you?
No.
It just seems exhausting.
Well.
And what?
Well, that's what got me into trouble with maybe the biggest failure explosion of a podcast of all time. And this was after
that's right.
Nancy Jo Sales making a joke about not having been on a date since 1988. And everything went south from that moment with her.
I wanted so much to be on that podcast with you, but you held your own. And I knew that you were not going to give up and back down. And she thought she could get you to relent. You did not relent. You kept saying, well, I just want to understand. And for those who don't remember the episode, she started dating in her 50s, was it?
50s? Yeah, it was her. She was a writer for Vanity Fair. She wrote a book about dating on the apps and how terrible it was.
But she advertised herself as a woman of a certain age who just wanted sex, right? Young guys.
Right. No. So she was trying to make a general point about how terrible dating on apps is. And but then you read the book and she was this big writer on technology and had done important reporting on technology. So I'm like, oh, this could be really interesting. You know, what do these apps do to you? And how do they sort of kill intimacy and change up the way we date? And it turned out that she has, and as a 50-year-old woman, set her parameters, I guess, for only dating men between age 24 and 30 and only for sex, which is fine, you know, if that's what you want. So she had predictably a series of encounters of men, I don't know, possibly her Uber drivers and DoorDash deliverers who came into her New York apartment, had sex with her. But her great astonishment was that they didn't
want a commitment. They wouldn't make a commitment.
And then I said, why, what were you thinking? Why did you think they would want to commit? And that's when she lost it.
She lost it and said that you were slut shaming her.
Yeah. Oh, that was epic. That was fun. But I remember sitting there thinking, if I just held my cool and let her scream at me.
No, it's an old debate. If you're, you know, in a debate and your opponent is self-destructing, let them self-destruct. Don't interrupt. And you were very good at that.
Well, I like the other podcast disaster we had. That was so Nancy Jo Sales hung up on us.
She hung up on you. And then some other people.
The Race to Dinner Ladies.
Oh, the Race to Dinner Ladies. Okay,
that was before Black Lives Matter.
Syra Rao and
Regina Jackson.
Yes.
So they were, this was, oh, I don't know, maybe the spring before sort of the Black Lives Matter movement erupted. And these were sort of, I guess, pioneers in this kind of wokeism where they read Robin DiAngelo and how you're just every white person is innately racist. And fine, if you want to believe that, except that they would go to suburban women's houses and these women would pay them $2,000, I think, a pop, to come to their dinner, and they'd assemble some of their friends. And then Robin and Sarah would lecture them on how racist
their white privilege.
Their white privilege and just basically insult you through the whole dinner about your whiteness. And we had them on and we said, we're going to do this. Let's pretend we're having a virtual dinner or a cocktail, whatever you want. And you start telling us about our racism. And it was just funny because if you question them, they weren't used to having any questions act about their presumptions.
No, and any doubts about what they were doing only proved to them how important it was that they had to continue doing it and how obviously in need we were of their services because we didn't just praise them.
Right. And I asked about sort of, well, first of all, they began by making a series of pronouncements. Forget white people. They said all Asian, like literally said all Asians are racist. And they made these sweeping judgments about other groups. And I said, isn't that racist? And they lost it. And they finally brought on a woman named Genevieve. They said, get Genevieve on the phone because she was a white woman. And they felt that.
And she was a facilitator, a crisis facilitator who could come in when conversations were going badly.
Right. But it was almost like she said, I need someone to speak white to you. So Genevieve came on. Because clearly what they were saying to us,
Sarah, she's Indian.
Yes, she's Indian.
But that's a group that's guilty too.
So. Oh, one of the most racist societies because of the caste system.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah. So that, so in the end, I remember you saying they, and you said, we even lost Genevieve. You were so upset.
We even lost the facilitator. She was the most well-meaning person.
Right. Well, I always thought I had been the more fiery one, but it turns out you actually were
aggressive.
No, not the more aggressive, but the more opinionated.
Oh,
I think you were the stronger opinions.
I'm afraid to listen to some of these, but partly because on this podcast, I drank a lot. And I realized it's not that I'm loud when I get drunk, but I do become opinionated. I just did a podcast with my stepson. We do this annual stepmother son bickering session, a post Thanksgiving drunken binge, you know, just arguing about everything. And I was so opinionated about everything and just this and this and this and this and sort of didactic and stentorian and that's what I do when I drink too much. So I think if we were to do this again, I'd still drink.
Have you ever been listening to a podcast and wish that you could get a little more out of the experience? Well, Vodacast is the new exciting app that provides podcast listeners deeper digital stories with interactive podcasts. So let's say you're listening to a podcast about a crime. And if you're listening on the Vodacast app, you can see CCTV video footage of the suspect. Or if it references an article and you're listening on the Vodacast app, you can click on the link to check out the article. Podcasts come alive with images and links paired with audio. Download the app and go to the top of the Discover page to listen to and see podcasts with deeper digital stories. With Vodacast, you're not just listening, you're experiencing. Available in the App Store.
The Femsplainers is brought to you in part by Progressive. What's one thing you'd purchase with a little extra savings? A spa day? That pair of shoes you've been coveting? Well, Progressive wants to make sure you're getting what you want by helping you save money on car insurance. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive can save over $700 on average, and customers can qualify for an average of 6 discounts when they sign up. Discounts like having multiple vehicles on your policy. Progressive offers outstanding coverage and award-winning claim service. Day or night, they have customer support 24/7, 365 days a year. When you need them most, they're at their best. A little off your rate each month goes a long way. Get a quote today at progressive.com and see why 4 out of 5 new auto customers recommend Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2020 and May 2021. Potential savings will vary, discounts vary, and are not available in all states and situations.
Well, so, okay, some of the people who surprised me by being different from who they, what you expected. So one of
I fell in love with one of our guests.
Which one?
Susan Rice.
She was one of the people I just thought, I was completely not what I expected.
And had she made it through, and Biden had chosen her, she wasn't favored by anybody because of Benghazi. So the right would have gone crazy over that. And the left didn't like her. I forget why.
Not radical enough.
Not radical enough. But she was such a solid person, so intelligent, a wry sense of humor, completely brilliant.
Written a very honest memoir, which is
honest.
Why she'd come
and
on.
What I liked about her, she had a son who was at Stanford, who was a Republican,
a Trumpian,
practically MAGA, yeah. Maybe MAGA.
He was MAGA.
And she kind of modeled a sort of sympathetic understanding for someone with whom you disagree, and it was just someone dearest to her heart. She could have been so great for the country. We could use her right now. I was so upset when he didn't choose her after meeting her.
Right. The politics of the previous the Obama administration kind of, and she hadn't ever been elected to anything. That was the
other
thing.
She had.
That being said, we totally would have voted for her. All right. We had Tina Brown. That was fantastic when she had her memoirs come out.
Can I tell you something funny about Tina Brown?
Yeah. By the way, Christina is saying this and she's got Izzy on her lap and she's stroking her.
I'm not stroking her. I'm holding her muzzle.
It looked like you were. You said, can I tell you something about Tina Brown?
Because she's
some villain. Stroking the careless cat.
You knew her and I did, but we had her and she was wonderful. And the whole thing was frothy and brilliant, just as Tina is. But then you and I went to some event in New York. I guess it was the
Women in the World Conference,
right?
Her last one, I think, because they got shut down by the pandemic.
And then I thought that our podcast had gone so well, not thinking to myself, she probably does dozens of these a day. She just had a book out. It probably didn't register that who I was, she knew you, but we ran into her. And I felt like what's that movie, Rami and Marie's Reunion or something? We were all dressed up and we were, Tina, hi. And she was like, who are you?
It was one of those dreadful big crushes. Yeah. So many more important people here
than
I
knew.
There
were so many. And on her behalf, she had just held like the biggest event in the world
yeah.
with people, world leaders and all that. And then
So we ended up going across the street to that funny Irish bar in New York
and drinking and, you know, and commiserating, but we were happy.
we had fun. We always made it fun. Of course we had Ayaan Hircea Lee on,
goddess
known forever. What were some of the things when, sorry, that was easy. When, we started this and we talked about the original one. One of the reasons we decided to do it was because Me Too had kind of really, at that moment, was a real force, and it had many, many good things going for it. It kind of had a resurgence of feminism, that feminism, such as it was, had kind of lapsed. People didn't really call themselves feminists anymore, like the National Organization for Women, which was so enormous when we and I were writing in the 90s, seemed to just, and remains a big nothing now.
Yeah, where is it now? You never hear about it.
But well, it can't be the National Organization for Women anymore.
It'd well, first of all, its name is problematic.
It would have to be the National Organization for Persons with Wombs.
No, even that. And also, I think, not to be ageist, but hell, I'm an old lady, I can say it. They're old. They must be all of them over 60.
Right, but they never reinvented themselves. But anyway,
they tried, but it was impossible.
Such as it was, they never, all those things had kind of receded. There were new issues. And then Me Too just roared in and
reminded us that there was still serious problems that had not been solved, and that sexual harassment was going on in ways that were quite shocking. And so it was a moment. And then with Trump and
Trump, the candidate
was problematic and then got voted in despite grab him by the pussy.
Oh, pussy hat
and the pussy hat. So, yeah, but even fairly soon after the movement began, there were signs of trouble, that it was becoming an occasion of a kind of sexual McCarthyism, mm-hmm. and naming names and not obviously guilty predators like Harvey Weinstein or Bill Cosby and some others. But, you know, this list was circulated, the shitty men in media list, where I mean, some of them were shitty men and some of them weren't, but their names were there and they were hurt.
And
that.
Their careers were destroyed. Yeah. And it was kind of extrajudicial. Yes. That obviously not every bad act, you know, can be prosecuted. I mean, a lot of the things that were happening to women and what was so powerful about that movement were things that, you know, you're not going to fire someone. You're not going to, you arrest them for sexual assault, but that creepy, condescending behavior that has been going on since the beginning of time, it was called out, and that was a good thing. But then it became like, remember, what was that comedian Ansari? Men were getting canceled for a bad date or serving not good wine on a date.
And this vicious person just shamed him for no reason. And she didn't sound like a fun date either. And, the thing that was astonishing is that it hurt him. I mean, he's had a comeback. He's so talented. You're not going to hold him back for too long, but he was damaged. And though I think that case, changed the movement, people began to be skeptical and realize that, innocent people were being destroyed or harmed unfairly. Mm-hmm. And we were starting about that time when.
Yeah, that we were in the middle of it. And then it became believe them at all cost, believe their feelings mattered more than any objective assessment of a situation. So remember, we had Caitlin Flanagan. Like
that was one of my favorite friends. We went to L.A.
We were in L.A., right?
Because I was on the Bill Maher show.
Right.
And he talked about, he mentioned the femsplainers.
Yes, that he did. That was very exciting for me. But so Caitlin came on, and this was when, God, I don't know if we should even mention her name because it's like poking a
Felicia Sanmez. She's probably still listens and monitors. She's now suing
The Washington Post.
Washington Post.
But this was a woman who Caitlin memorably called a Hellcat.
Oh, a Hellcat. I couldn't remember. It was she devil or Hellcat. she is a Hellcat. Mainly, she just seems to be a very needy, whiny, neurotic, and dangerous, therefore dangerous.
Right. Well, she had destroyed this man's life who worked then at
Beijing.
He was a Beijing correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and she was in Beijing, and they had a hookup. And then that's where it was like fatal attraction. I mean, Emily Yaffe, who was on, also whom we love, she's with Now Persuasion. She wrote maybe the most exhaustive article about what parsing together what happened. And in the end, it's one of those things. If you could say, well, maybe he didn't behave that well, maybe she didn't behave that well, but there was nothing beyond.
Nobody broke a law.
He wasn't her boss.
They were equals.
And just not only did she get him fired and out of Beijing,
he lost a book contract.
She came out and she's been relentless. And then anybody who questions her story, she goes after, including, and what was the irony of all this sisterhood was Caitlin. Then I did a tweet about on this guy's behalf. She said, you know, you've destroyed his life. He's suicidal, which he was at that point.
Right.
Unemployable. And what more do you want, Felicia? And Felicia started bombarding the Atlantic.
Trying to get her fired.
Trying to get Caitlin fired.
And then she tried to get Emily Yaffe fired.
Right. And then when she got word, Caitlin called her a Hellcat. It started all over again.
Meanwhile, this is the woman minutes after Kobe Bryant
dies
in the horrible flames with his little daughter, and everyone is in shock and mourning. She tweets, well, he had an unresolved, sexual assault case, and starts to bring all of this up. And it was just not the moment for that. And so I think someone at the Post told her, Felicia, stop tweeting.
It was actually Marty Baron. The editor said, Felicia, just stop. Yeah, just stop. And then that was.
And the Post was being inundated by protests and phone calls and, emails like protesting how offensive it was that she was doing. And that's part of her lawsuit, that she was silenced.
Well, she was silenced because they at that point they realized, OK, this woman is a bit of a liability, and they didn't want her to cover
the Kavanaugh
hearing. Because she kept describing herself as a victim of sexual assault.
And yeah, a survivor.
A survivor.
And just to stop for a second. Yeah. Here's a woman appropriating the language, of the Holocaust. And to describe.
Or let alone women who have been brutally.
Or anything
or
frightening
or
and terrifying. Nothing happened to her that was frightening and terrifying. And by her own words, because that's what Emily Yaffe was able to do, was to look at her own accounts, to various accounts. It was a bad date at worst, but she turned it into an assault and a violation. And now she's a survivor and goes with that.
She's like anti-vaxxers who compare themselves to,
Holocaust victims.
Holocaust victims.
Or Jews that had to wear yellow stars because you have to have.
Right. No, it's
been
just
vaccinated.
It's over the top. Anyway, well, that's enough about her. But has your thinking changed since we began doing this, or what sort of, how has it evolved? So we entered doing it because we're kind of, wow, this stuff is all coming back. I got piqued. I hadn't written specifically about women's issues for a few years. And then I got really interested again because I felt it was important for me. Doing the podcast was a way to speak to younger women of our my daughter's generation.
Both you and I have always been sort of moderate feminists, or what I used to call equality feminists. Of course, we believe in equal opportunities and against, wanting stronger laws against harassment and better policies protecting rape victims and so forth. All of that was completely legitimate. But I've been, and you were a critic of other parts of feminism where they were so hostile to traditional femininity or women who made conventional choices. I wanted a feminism that allowed women to make unorthodox choices, that allowed people to defect from the stereotypes of femininity. But on the other hand, many of us embody them. And I wanted, you know, a place for feminine women or, you know, traditional women as well. And that seemed to be very hard. But what's changed in the last 4 years is that the feminists that I used to fight, who were the radical feminists, because they really didn't like men. And I thought they exaggerated the crimes of men. Mm-hmm. And they had a whole set of
the patriarchy
statistics about patriarchal oppressors and so forth. And I challenged them. But it's funny because many of them have now become my allies because of the trans movement.
Right.
And it's not that I agree with their positions on men, but I hate the way they've been silenced and in some cases just treated quite brutally and threatened. And so now some of the people that I champion, Janice Raymond, I mean, she was this radical feminist. I thought her views were so extreme. But her and the people who follow her now, people like Kathleen Stock. There's what's her name? The British feminist.
Oh, Helen Joyce and Julie Burchell.
And Julie Bendel. Bendel.
Oh, Julie Bendel. Bendel.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, Julie Bendel is somebody I once would have crossed. Now I am so proud to be on her side.
Well, I think it's an interesting convergence because I think where you and I agreed is that there are biological differences. And that a feminism that championed women to be exactly the same as men, have exactly the same career trajectories, do exactly the same things, have babies, walk away, pretend biology played no role in not just what you do, but in your whole desires and thinking.
Your persona, your essential being.
And the feminists that we used to bug us or we used to argue with, like the ones you just described, saw women, they saw it in almost an extreme way. You used to call it fainting couch feminism, that we were, not only were we very, very, very different from those oppressors, men, but anything, you know, we couldn't handle anything. We couldn't handle ourselves. We couldn't handle a stray
off-color
comment.
Jokes, you know, a man in an elevator, you know, making a little, you know,
remark,
risque remark.
And with Me Too, we saw some of that attitude come back, but it's, I'm sorry. Is he in the green screen?
She's behind the green screen. You know, she just finds ways of making herself unpleasant. And she acts like a bad little boy.
But so we fundamentally agreed on the fact that there were biological differences. And then what is weird about the trans movement and what we recognize in it, and as we always have to do, this is not about if you really feel this way. And
of course, we're kind and compassionate and respectful of people. If they were present as trans, they want to give me their pronouns. I, of course, would use whatever pronouns they wanted, right, and potentially love them. Some of the people that I adore, like I guess one of my favorite economists is, oh God, I'm blanking out her new name.
Deirdre McCloskey.
Sorry, Deirdre. But she was trans before it was fashion.
Well, but what we're seeing is now this movement, and it is all trans women. It's not going the other way.
Right.
Deciding that they are, and it's actually wonderful. I like to think of it, it's not mansplaining, but it's transplaining.
Transplaining
when
is a problem.
Somebody is telling you what a woman is.
Yeah.
And kind of trying to say, on the one hand, being a woman is almost a cartoon of being a woman. But yet you don't need a womb. You don't need to have gone through a female adolescence. You don't need, it kind of completely negates and all the, you know, the achievements and the real differences that we as women have been struggling with. So as we're seeing with this swimmer, I think this swimmer might be the
shark jump.
The shark. This is the, I forget what state, do you remember which state swimmer is in? Having gone through a full male adolescence, University of Pennsylvania, and was a male champion swimmer, decided he was a woman, and is now breaking all the records. And you're looking at these girls who've trained their whole lives, you know, every winter's morning, swimming and swimming and swimming, just being blown out of the water, as it were.
And stories of
losing scholarships,
of men declaring themselves trans and getting placed in female prisons and then preying on prisoners. Now, to give the other side, they'll say these cases are very rare. You're just cherry picking. It shouldn't happen. It shouldn't be possible. Right. So it shows that even at the level of kind of official state policy, these things can happen.
Right. Well, you see state policy being made based on this false premise that a man who does not even, as I like to say, walk the walk,
yeah,
who has decided, I don't want to go to one of the men's prisons, says, well, actually identify as a woman. And he could be bearded and have, you know, body hair,
yeah, because now,
and a bruiser. And
there was a time where I think there were some requirements before you were could illegally be considered. Right. But now it's just what you say you are.
And we've seen actual cases, and they're not cherry picking, of rapists, sexual assaulters being placed in women's prisons. And it's nuts. It's just nuts. And I think that's what offends people. It's not out of a lack of compassion. It's not out of a lack of recognition for differences. It's a real assault on women's rights and who women are.
And so there, when the radical feminists would talk about women's spaces,
right?
And I used to think, well, what are you talking about? Are you afraid of men? Well, now I sort of agree with them. If the women's spaces, the idea that we're going to have
a women's shelter,
and you can have men, or to have bathrooms. I probably said this before on the podcast, but I'm still triggered by it. I was staying in this very hip hotel in Brooklyn, and there was, in the lobby, there was a bathroom downstairs, and I went there, and it was gender neutral. And first of all, it was a scary bathroom to begin with, even
well, a lot of those bathrooms in Brooklyn, male or female.
But there could have been a man next to me, you know. I would have been terrified. I was terrified. Anyway, women are not going to put up with having men in stalls next to them. And it's shocking that we don't have a feminist movement that could protect us from these kinds of incursions in dressing rooms, bathrooms, prisons, and play. And I'm talking about not just because it's aesthetically displeasing, which it is. I mean, men's bathrooms, well, never mind that. But
men's dorm rooms, forget even men's
bathrooms. Forget even the bathrooms.
Men's frat houses.
Even my bathroom, when men are there. But
yeah, my son's bathroom. My son after he's used the bathroom. Sorry, Nat, sorry.
You know, speaking of that, there was an experiment, I think in Holland, where they put like a little bullseye in the toilet where men should hit mm-hmm. when they pee, and it eliminated splashing on the floor because they were so engaged with the challenge.
Apparently that's a thing. We don't know this, but apparently those kind of all kinds of things we don't know about men's bathrooms. And you know what? I don't want to know. When it comes to feminine health issues, we're often embarrassed or ashamed to talk about them. And especially the one I'm about to bring up, which, if I'm guessing, if it was a male problem, men might even boast about it. I'm talking about odor from down there. Yes. Okay, I'll say it. Vaginal odor. Who are you going to call? Well, when Deanna Seymour Story, CEO and founder of women's wellness brand PhD Feminine Health, was working in the pharmaceuticals industry 6 years ago, she discovered no one. There was no one you could call except your doctor. And as she said, quote, "During that time, I got so frustrated getting the same medications and having really disappointing results. I was in search of a holistic solution for vaginal issues, but it was imperative to me to find an ingredient that was backed by published clinical data." So Seymour started researching boric acid and came across dozens of studies that had been done on this ingredient, but no one was manufacturing it commercially. Thus, PhD was born. Boracic acid is a natural compound found in seawater and has been recommended by medical professionals for decades as a safe, holistic alternative. PhD is now the number one doctor-recommended brand of boric acid vaginal suppositories. When you have feminine issues, you want a solution immediately. PhD offers trustworthy feminine care products that actually work. Plus, you'll be supporting a female-owned and founded company. So, these days, PhD believes that self-care is crucial to your overall well-being. Give the gift of self-care and love to yourself. Register now at phdfemininehealth.com/win to receive a free lifestyle subscription box from our friends at Bombay and Cedar, which contain vegan and cruelty-free deluxe-size beauty and lifestyle products, a retail value of over $100, plus a $500 Visa gift card. So go to phdfemininehealth.com, phdfemininehealth.com/win, and you'll also get 20% off all products right now. Use code FEM, F-E-M, FEM, to get 20% off at phdfemininehealth.com/win. But to go back to what we were saying earlier about the National Organization for Women, is they should be engaged
leading
in
leading this and protecting women where we are vulnerable.
And one of our guests, whom I really loved, and she was fairly recently in this past year, Helen Joyce, who wrote the book on trans, she said something I thought was very profound.
Was it Helen Joyce? Or was
Helen
it?
Joyce.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Helen Joyce.
She said one of the failures she felt of American feminism or the American women's movement was a lack of tangible achievements, that, like, whether it was, you know, leave, paid leave, or policies in other countries that had done genuinely helpful things for women that changed the kind of playing field that we never got.
We got them, interestingly enough, in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s. There was some
equal pay for equal work.
Feminist historians have said it was like the golden age of feminism. And there was a Supreme Court case, one after the other. There was major legislation that happened very early. After the Second World War, after Betty Friedan and that whole, suddenly conservatives and liberals, Republicans and Democrats came together and agreed that it was time to eliminate just these unjustified distinctions where a woman could be fired if she got pregnant from, you know, being a teacher and things like that. They got rid of those laws and had the Equal Pay Act.
But then there was nothing really, this sort of conversation ended, and it is crazy. And I'm not a policy expert. We've talked about this before, but it's not that I think, oh, you know, a federal leave, you know, parental leave program is going to work. In many ways, there's big downsides to that. But the fact,
it's interesting, the downsides. Right. Sweden and Denmark have shown the downside. If you have very generous parental leave, first of all, mostly it's women who take it. You kind of have to coerce men into taking it. And secondly, the more that women get, the more they like it, and the less likely they are to go back to the workplace. So that's why American women, not that I think this is a good thing, I actually admire the Swedish and Danish policies, but one advantage of ours is there are far more women in upper management, far more women CEOs, and just
right, but there, powered. But there's no help for female cashiers, you know, and it goes to this, to what we were talking about, the original thinking, as it were, where because we can't be in agreement that women need X or Y and men need X or Y, because we cannot have that discussion at all, and haven't been able to have it since, I don't know, 1980, 1979.
Well, even the current threats to
we can't actually
Roe
cope
v.
with
Wade.
The issues.
Even the current threats to Roe v. Wade, which would have been shocking 15 years ago, you know, there's relative silence. And I think it's because the women's movement is powerless. Mm-hmm. And because they have given over the power to the trans movement. And someone should have thought that through and seen that.
I would also say, I'd be interested in hearing you say how you think it's the trans movement. I think it's because feminists took a very, very radical stance on abortion. And just as, you know, like the old Monty Python sketch in Meaning of Life, every sperm is sacred, just as the pro-life go to one end and say, you know, the moment of conception, that's it. You know, it's a real life. It's true. It is.
Yeah.
No one would dispute that. It's going to be someone, it's going to be a person. So you're making a decision, but you're weighing all the other factors versus have an abortion for any reason up till birth. is also not an answer. And that's the problem. You've never been able, and then it got enshrined as this constitutional right, which I don't think is correct.
Well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg said it wasn't the best way to achieve the right.
It was
legally incoherent.
But that being said, so there is, you know, you can come up with, at least for what would be the majority of the population, a humane policy on abortion, but it's not going to have, you know, you could have a, well, in the first trimester, any reason after the second trimester, you know, different circumstances, but we've never been able to have that conversation. And then of course the states all approach it differently. And
it's very important what you say about having the conversation, because that's what you have to preserve, is an environment where people can, and whatever your politics, you should be able to be. In fact, I remember once early on, she did turn out to have some errant views on many things, but I kind of admired Naomi Wolf at one point, published a piece questioning our cavalier attitudes towards abortion. Mm-hmm. And she had some interesting arguments. And then she was just destroyed.
You can't do it.
And I have come to the decision, I kind of accept the idea that you should be able to have it until whenever you want it. But I would not impose that on others. And I'm open to being proved wrong. I think the problem with abortion is that it's a metaphysical issue. It's never going to be resolved, because the question is, when does a human life begin? And that's...
Well, we know when a human life begins, and it does begin at conception. What you have to then weigh is the mother's circumstances, the woman's circumstances.
I mean, a human life in some meaningful moral way.
Right.
And worthy of protection and human rights. And you don't want to say that just a primitive sort of cluster of cells has benefits of.
Exactly. Exactly. But as you say, and look, you know, we talk about going to back to back alley abortions, which is, I think we're going to start to see, obviously, in certain states ruling it out.
We're going to see that.
But there were also women were prey, especially women looking for advanced abortions, to equally terrible doctors and experiences, you know, just horrible situations out of desperation. So making it safe and legal, as the argument goes, is a worthy goal. But there have to be parameters where doctors, the medical professionals, agree what is ethical. You know, not every doctor is going to want to abort a 28-week fetus for no other reason except, you know, the mother doesn't want it.
I think the reason you would abort a 28-week fetus is perhaps it's going to be born without a brain, or there's
Of course, but that's not what the argument is, though.
Right.
And obviously, but you can usually find that anyway. We don't have to go down the abortion thing.
But, you know, I will always remember one of the first moments where I sort of questioned my position, very, very libertarian position on abortion, was when I called up I was living in Brookline and I really, really wanted to be pregnant. And I took a pregnancy test at the Harvard Community Health Plan. And the nurse called me to tell me that I was pregnant. And I was like, you know, just jumping up and down. And I mean, not to her, but just in my mind. And then she said, will you carry this to term or do you want to abort? And that was the question, you know, like... And I was like, no, don't abort it. I wanted him so much. That's all. I'm not dead yet. I couldn't believe it. And I'm sure they don't do that now, but that was the mood at the time. It was just like no one was going to want this in 1984.
Right. Because we were all so busy tying our little bow ties around our...
Pretending we were men.
Pretending.
It makes me, it reminds me that how sad I am that today this biologist E.O. Wilson has died, and he was one of the great, he was a field biologist and he was an expert on ants, and he was a genius and he won every conceivable prize and was esteemed in every way. But he had a brief period of intense controversy when he published a book called Sociobiology, in which he tried to trace some of the basis for human behavior, things like that are very deeply ingrained, like tribalism and kin altruism, the parent-child bond, the taboo against incest. He tried to show how we evolved to have these qualities and how they favored our survival as we were evolving. And he always liked to say that the difficult thing for human beings today is that we have Paleolithic brains, we have medieval institutions and godlike technology. Mm-hmm. But our Paleolithic brain, he studied and he thought you really can't know who you are or in the human, who, what is the purpose of life? What is a human being? Unless you understand our prehistory. And so he tried to bring that alive. One of the first attempted cancelings, people treated E.O. Wilson, this brilliant biologist, they treated him like he was, he was called all sorts of names, a neo-Nazi, that he was justifying eugenics. He wasn't doing any of that. He was a complete innocent. He didn't even know that this would be controversial. But he had a huge influence on my thinking because as I was evaluating feminism, I was thinking that you have to take into account human nature and that on average, women are profoundly bonded to their babies, maybe more than men. And that may explain why we're more likely to want to retreat from other pursuits, especially when they're very little. And I just thought that we should allow some of the science into the sociology. And that's what E.O. Wilson was. He was a great proponent of he worries that too much of our social policy is driven by twisted theories from the humanities. And he wants to have like sound information from the sciences. He thought the sciences should join the humanities and should be. But right now, too much is, as I said, coming from these humanities, which became dominated by radical feminists. And E.O. Wilson, who died today,
as we record this,
it's a great loss. But I urge everyone to go back and read his books, listen to a lecture. And he, if you want a hero, it's E.O. Wilson. And it wasn't just because he had theories that did a lot to explain human nature in terms of our biology. He wasn't rigid about it, but he thought we had to take it into account. But he was also one of the first conservationists, environmentalists, and a proponent of biodiversity, and warned us that the biospheres is this little thin layer of life and life, and it's fragile. And he said that what we should do is instead of making everybody feel guilty about global warming, and which we should do, but instead of only doing that, start teaching kids about life and about the biosphere, about rainforests, about reefs, about these delicate ecologies, and kids love it. It's fascinating. But it creates an awareness of the need to be a custodian and protective, because mm-hmm. without that, we're gone. But the bad side is we may be doomed. We're just a very bad species.
Well, I also just think we always, the people who feel most doomed are us older people. And that may be also a reflection on the state of life we're in. Things aren't as good as in the youthful. Speaking to the science, I think this is where you and I have also always agreed on in terms of our view of feminism is science, and that these differences between men and women are science-based. And one of my favorite guests who came on was Carol Hooven, the Harvard who she wrote this amazing book called Testosterone, and just it was the most fascinating book, just not just what it does to you and the differences it creates between men and women, but sort of a kind of history of it. And she noted outright that if you are a man and you have gone through adolescence, it doesn't matter what you do, you know, this whole idea, sorry to go back on this, we'll get off this, Olympic committee saying, well, just don't take hormones or whatever for a year. Yeah. Doesn't matter. You are going to have an innate advantage. So I think that's where we've always agreed.
Anyone in e-commerce just loves that sound. It means there's been another sale on Shopify, the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big business. So upstarts, startups, and established businesses alike can sell everywhere, synchronize online and in-person sales, and effortlessly stay informed. Scaling your business is a journey of endless possibility. Before I was doing the Femsplainers, you guys might not know this, but I ran an online business using Shopify, and it couldn't have been easier or quicker to set up and start making sales. And Shopify has the tools and resources that make it easy for any business to succeed from down the street or around the globe. Shopify powers over 1.7 million businesses from first sale to full scale. Reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps, including Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. And synchronize your online and in-person sales. Gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting of conversion rates, profit margins, and beyond. More than a store, Shopify grows with you. This is possibility powered by Shopify. So go right now to shopify.com/femsplainers, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/femsplain. all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to Shopify, that's shopify.com/femsplain, all lowercase, right now. Shopify.com/femsplain. I was thinking about how has my thinking changed since doing this podcast. And one of the things that I've learned from it is it's given me, I guess this was also the point of why I wanted to do it. It's given me a much greater insight into millennials and Gen Z and what they're thinking. Had a lot of people come on, including Glenn Lukianoff, who with Jonathan Haidt name that book, Christina.
No, okay. Okay. This is my Bible.
Wrote about,
shit.
I want to say,
I am cognitively compromised, but that's because of this Dubonnet.
Anyway, about this generation and their increased suicide rates and that they're not having sex. And then when they do have sex, it's terrible, and depression and anxiety. And so I've really come to appreciate what they're going through.
I have come to appreciate it, but I was trying to find this passage from this novelist, I don't know, maybe he was a pornographer, Henry Miller, who said that, overall, if you've got your health and you have enough to eat, you have an obligation to be happy. And he thought that it was just like every miserable loser has the capacity to be miserable. He thought it took a talent and imagination to be happy. And I think to the millennials out there, I can't find this passage, and don't try to find it, because God forbid what you would find in Henry Miller, but not the greatest novelist, but really a funny guy. But anyway, I think there is an obligation to be happy.
Or to try to be happy, but...
And to make other people happy.
Well, I think that is an absolute, that should be a femsplainer golden rule.
Yeah.
But I also understand that...
But that's how you can be happy.
We are dealing with forces, and I mean... the internet and the smartphone that have been so disruptive, and especially to that generation that's never known anything else, that we're really just, I want to say unpacking. We just don't know.
You wonder, like, what was it like to live through the French Revolution, or how did people feel when
the printing press was invented?
The Gutenberg Bible. Yeah. But of course that was taking place over decades and decades and centuries. So we're at this key moment, this revolution in information and even personal identity. If you think about so many things that have been changed because of that.
Well, there's a whole alternative universe. I mean, you've discovered this on Twitter, but I think it's generally true. There's a whole alternative universe going on that's contained in this little thing you carry around in your pocket, your phone.
Right. And you have more in that little device than they had in the greatest
libraries of Congress, Smithsonian. But I take that very seriously. Caitlin, I'm going to mangle one of Caitlin's great observations, but, you know, a 13-year-old boy has seen more porn than a World War II sailor. I mean, she has a great, you know.
And somebody pointed out, we now routinely allow young people, young boys and girls, access to, you know, images that prior generations did all they can to make sure never happened.
Right.
You know, the kids couldn't see the movies or the postcards,
or they put the Playboys up on the shelf with the little cardboard barriers in front of them.
So it's going to be different. And, you know, I like to be optimistic and think it'll all work out, and maybe it will, probably it will, but who knows?
Well, one of the things I hope for, and that's come out of this podcast, is that we have given more hopeful, happier alternatives to current thinking. You know, we've tried, I was actually on a podcast the other day, a 30 something man. I was the guest for once. I was a guest, Christina.
Oh my God.
And, 30 something male podcaster, said to me, what he really enjoyed about listening to the Femsplainers was our mansplainers coming on. Like, we had Sam Harris, we had David Brooks, we had my husband, David Frum. But not talking about their politics or their ideas, but talking about their marriages, their views on life, how they think, you know, very frank, shrewd and wise observations and advice, you know, on the sexes and on our relationships. And he said I was really thrilled. He said he learned a lot from that. So I think if there's anything I hope our listeners took away, was these happier, more positive views of marriage, of love, of motherhood, of ways to be men and women without killing each other, without resenting each other.
And just a suggestion to younger generations out there is that men and women are different. And if you are living with a man, married to a man, he is not going to be like your girlfriend. He'll try. If he's a sweet guy, he'll make every effort in the world, you know, to listen to, you know, and try to, you know, help you with your emotions and all that. But he may not be that interested, at least not as interested as you are. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't, as a rule, there are exceptions. I'm talking about the rule. He doesn't care that much about
rom-coms
or whether or not the bed is made or the curtains match the dust ruffle.
I thought you were going somewhere else.
No, I'm not going there. They are just different, but there are simple, basic truths about the universe.
The differences are what.
And the different, and admit it, like, that's kind of why you love him. I mean,
you don't want him to be like you.
You don't want him to be a girly girl.
Well, it's interesting. This young podcaster asked me about children. He was unmarried, but his brother was married and about to become a father to a nephew. And he had, you know, sort of seeking advice about what do we tell our boys? Because what you tell your sons, even today, is still different from what you tell your daughters. But he was sort of saying, well, you know what, you felt suddenly that he wanted to have that life, that it's also true that even though men have a longer shelf life, as it were, for being single, they don't have the same biological pressures. And one of my favorite guests, by the way, is Evan Mark Katz, this amazing dating coach we've had on, who
is so good.
He's so wise about this. Even men eventually want a home life and love and children.
And those men, and if you have a home life and you have children, it is good for your health, your longevity.
Right. They're not going to go
happiness,
fall off a ladder and kill themselves and have no one there to tell them to go to the doctor and things. But it's we all want this. The basic thing is the sexes, to speak generally, the sexes want the same thing. And they want And we have made everything look terrible, I think. Just, again, speaking generalizations, we've made marriage look like a struggle, a constant, what do they say? Every day is work, you know, like, screw that. And then having children, you look at it from the outside, looks like a freaking nightmare. You know, like, what possible benefit could there be to surrendering, you know, your great DoorDash, Netflix lifestyle to having this disruption.
And message to Gen Zers, because the millennials won't listen. Dogs are not children.
Dogs are not children.
I love my dog, but I said she is not a child. It's not the same thing. And
even though you love them as you think,
I love them. I love Izzy.
But it's the thing that having children does. And this is what I said to him was, there is nothing more liberating than not having to think about yourself all the time.
Exactly.
And not being, you know, you think, oh, selflessness, sacrifice. Oh my God. What a liberation that is when you are thinking about others, when you have this
and you care about them more than you care about yourself. And it's a liberation.
It is a liberation. And it's also you grow, you know, the Grinch's heart grew many sizes that day. Your heart just grows all these sizes and you can't, that is nothing you can teach. That is nothing you can demonstrate. You can only look at yourself in a child form and think, you know, well, was that so terrible? You know, I'm glad my parents were, I'm close to my parents or I'm close to my brothers and sisters. I'm really glad I exist and my life is rich because of it. And it would be terrible if all I had was a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a dog, you know, and not this expanded, rich life that goes over decades and generations. So that, but we don't talk about these things that way.
We don't talk about it. And you know, we don't teach people how to have a life together, because the dominant messages that people get are about, you know, how men, it's often anti-male. I won't talk about a recent New York Times op-ed about,
oh, we can't go there.
We won't go there because we'll never stop. But how,
just in short, this woman described her husband as a dirty pile of laundry sitting on the sofa. And she thought, she didn't think that was a bad thing to say in public.
You're right. She still loved him, but she was just warning you about marriage. But what I wanted was his point of view, like what she looks like. Because she doesn't always look so great. And the people have built up these expectations that you're getting some exalted kind of roommate who will feel the way you do about everything.
Right.
And just will understand.
Be you. Who will be you. And you don't want him.
You
want
to marry you. No. And you know what?
No, we decided, if you remember very early on, we decided we wanted to marry each other, but since we're not.
I know, she won't marry me, but that's what's come out of this. I'm in love with my co-splainer.
We get along very well. And you know what? Now that the podcast is ending, so here's my goal for the coming year. I want to write more, because now that I've learned so much from our listeners and from our guests, I feel I want to write a sequel to my book.
What Our Mothers Never Told Us.
No, it was What Our Mothers Didn't Tell Us. And I think I want to do a sequel called What We Tell Our Daughters. So that's the project in my head, even though no one reads. And the whole point of doing the podcast was accepting that young people don't read, but they do listen to audiobooks. So that's my hope.
And I'm listening to Middlemarch. And if you haven't listened to it, there's a brilliant recording
by George Eliot.
It's the novel by George Eliot, but it's about marriage, bad marriages, but also about love and the human condition. Yeah, actually, never mind. I'm getting carried away. It's E.O. Wilson and his science, but she's a literary figure who documented it. And it tells you so much about life, but it has the most beautiful ending because the characters in this novel,
spoiler alert.
No, this is not a spoiler alert because it doesn't tell what happens. She does get together with.
No,
never mind. In the end of this book, it's apparently George Eliot believed in something called incrementalism, which I believe in, which is about improving the world, not through a revolution, which creates havoc and on average, more misery than, you know, like the French Revolution.
Benefits certain
classes.
People. Yeah. Or organizers.
But incrementally, that there are individuals who just try to make things better, as Dorothea did in Middlemarch. And Lydgate, the doctor, tried to improve medicine. And these people, and they failed. There were setbacks, but there was this push forward. And at the very last line, it just says that you, everyone out there, whether you know it or not, your lives are better because of these unsung heroes and heroines, of the little goodnesses, these sort of minor acts of compassion and kindness. And I was just in tears when I finished it and thought that that is actually the philosophy that I believe in, which is that, because most of us aren't going to be heroes. We're not going to be
inscribed into museums.
No, but you can push forward these
boats passionate against the tide.
And I do think, even though we've both been vilified for this, is that when you and I warn people that don't always listen to the aggressive messages against marriage and family, or even being a housewife, and
that doesn't even exist anymore, I don't think. But yes.
Yeah, but it wasn't bad. Most women, well, compared to what they had when it emerged as a possibility, it was a vast improvement.
Well, post-war life was a vast improvement over
anything that women had before,
that had its flaws. But yeah, I want to revisit that. I want to take just time to think of what I've learned from this. I want to join you a little bit in the garden, and we have some things we're going to do together about enjoying life in small ways.
Small ways.
Small ways. We'll probably be those women in bucket hats on the Viking cruise in our Eileen
Fisher.
There
will be cruises.
There will,
no Eileen Fisher.
Warning. There will be cruises.
Although, I don't know. Now that I'm better friends with these radical feminists.
Oh,
maybe we can wear. No. We can wear Eileen Fisher, because I kind of love lesbians now.
Okay, but
the radical lesbians,
they don't wear Eileen Fisher.
I thought that was lesbian clothes.
No, that's kind of, apologies to all who listen to this, wear Eileen Fisher. There's nothing wrong with it. It's fashionable. There's a kind of comfort level to it. It's like chic retirement wear. It's not lesbian wear.
Oh.
It's chic retirement wear. A chic teacher wear is what it is, too.
Oh, God. That sounds good. I'm going to check it out.
But there is a kind of like, I'm not going down this, because we're going to be better than this.
We'll be better than this.
And we're going to spend time together. I'm going to think. I'm going to write. And you'll always be able to find us. I'm going to keep the Femsplainer site up, so you can always find our episodes, and they will remain on Podcast One and on iTunes. You'll find me on Substack under the Femsplainer's newsletter. I'm going to convert that into a kind of...
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, kind of Danielle Femsplainer newsletter.
Oh, and like that. And so sometimes newsletters have guest writers.
Oh, believe me, more than welcome.
Maybe
that would be wonderful.
I sort of want to write little things, but I'm...
But
I'm,
nothing. Yeah, we
just
all
Just because
do
I'm
that.
I'm now retired from that domain, but I've become...
A scribbler.
And what I like are these Edwardian era dilettantes. And I think that
you've become a dilettante. That's what you want. I want to be a dilettante.
Everyone does. And so I was looking for someone who believed in this philosophy, because I don't like the Marxists, because they just want to destroy this and make everybody workers.
I'm kind of passé.
I want to make everyone dilettantes.
Mm, okay. Well, that's a good 2022.
And so if anybody out there could tell me a philosopher, I think maybe Emma Goldman believed in that, but I'm not sure. I want to find a revolutionary who believed in, and we could do this with artificial intelligence, although it could turn against us and it might be justified.
Yes, stop
but
it on
artificial
the
intelligence could do like all the work, and then we will be liberated.
You mean they just write our newsletter for us?
They'll probably...
You already just volunteered yourself, and I'm going to seize on that, by the way.
I'm going to do that.
Anyway, Femsplainers on Substack. You can always find me at danielle@femsplainers.com, right? danielle@femsplainers.com is the email you'll find me at. And
CH at Twitter. I'm on Twitter.
Yep. Direct message Christina.
No DMs. I don't accept DMs.
Oh, never mind. Don't do that.
I mean, I do, but what am I saying? But it's at, what is my Twitter address?
CH Summers.
Follow me on Twitter. I'm active there. It's good company.
Yeah. Yeah. If you like hanging out with assholes.
No, my followers are not.
No, but in general.
I once had them and then I lost them and I'm glad, but never mind. That's another story.
So many more stories. Let's hope for many more stories. So cheers, my dear. Let's clink our glasses. Yeah, as always, when you come on, we have too much of something. And this is too much.
I warned you about the Dubonnet.
And let's all go change into our Eileen Fisher sweatshirts and sweatpants or elegant leisure wear.
Lesbian clothes.
And we be well, everybody. Thank you for being part of this. Part of this journey. Thank you for being part of this femsplainer journey. We love you. Thank you for all, especially our Patreon supporters. You guys have sustained the podcast. Thank you to Podcast One. Thank you to our previous host, Ricochet. Thank you to Nat Frum, my son, who also edits this.
Which heroically.
He gets paid.
Week after week, even paid.
I know. You have to listen to your mother and then you have to listen to your mother talk about embarrassing things. So thank you, Nat. We're really grateful to you, Nat.
Good guy.
Thank you to all of our guests who've been on. And cheers.
We'll be back.
Some form.
In some form or another.
Another lie.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. The Femsplainers is a weekly podcast carried on the Podcast One Network. Nat Frum produces and edits our audio and video. You can follow us on Twitter and FB at Femsplainers and on Instagram at Femsplainers Podcast. We love hearing from you. You can reach out to us via email at contact@femsplainers.com. You'll find all our episodes and more information about me and the podcast at femsplainers.com. And remember, we rely on your donations to keep this podcast going. So please consider supporting us at patreon.com/femsplainers.